Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We're seeing an unprecedented descent into darkness. No electricity, no internet, no water, no food, no aid. Bombs raining down on Gaza, more than 2,600 killed. An Israeli government signaling that they intend to commit mass atrocities. They must be stopped.
The death toll from the Israeli bombardment of Gaza has topped 2,700, including over 1,000 Palestinian children. Over 1 million residents of Gaza have been displaced. We'll talk to Omar Shaker of Human Rights Watch, then the Israeli historian Raz Siegel, who says Israel's assault on Gaza is a textbook case of genocide.
We're seeing a genocide unfolding in Gaza today, the Israeli attack on Gaza, which is quite exceptional in its character. As a Holocaust and Genocide Studies scholar, as a Jewish Holocaust and Genocide Studies scholar, this is of urgent concern for me. There may be still time to stop this unfolding attack, but we need to recognize it for what it is.
Then, over the past 10 days, at least 12 journalists, mostly Palestinian, have been killed in the war. We'll speak to the journalist Lama Alarian. Her close friend, the Reuters journalist Aysam Abdullah, was killed in an Israeli artillery strike in southern Lebanon.
A lot of officials from many different political parties and, of course, many, many journalist friends of his. He was buried along with his press jacket, and on top of his grave, they lined his grave with his cameras.
Lema joins us from Beirut. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, another 500,000 people, one quarter of its population, have fled their homes in the past few days as Israel bombards the besieged enclave for the 10th straight day and amidst an anticipated ground invasion. Last week, Israel ordered 1.1 million residents of northern Gaza to evacuate to the south, a virtually impossible task which would also constitute the war crime of forcible transfer. On Friday, Hamas officials said 70 people, mostly women and children, were killed when Israeli airstrikes hit convoys that were attempting to flee Gaza City. Over 2,800 Palestinians have been killed since Israel's assault began. Over 10,000 have been wounded. Palestinian health officials say 47 families have been entirely removed from the Gaza Civil Registry, meaning those families no longer have any remaining members. This is a Khan Yunis resident whose home was destroyed in Israeli airstrike.
This is a genocide, not a war. It's a genocide. And it's an attempt to displace the people of the Gaza Strip. But this will not happen.
At least 1,400 Israelis have been killed in Hamas attacks. Israel says 200 of its citizens are being held captive by Hamas. A growing crowd is massing at Gaza's Rafah border crossing with Egypt amidst reports the border will open today. Humanitarian groups are also relying on the border crossing to open to allow severely needed aid into Gaza, where residents are dealing with dwindling supplies of food, fuel, medicine, and water.
We don't have any water. We've reached a disastrous situation below zero. The situation is catastrophic by all standards, and with a food crisis, water and electricity, I mean, people can't do anything in the current conditions.
China has called on Israel to stop its, quote, collective punishment of the people of Gaza, unquote, saying Israel's gone beyond self-defense. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken swept through seven countries in the Middle East over the weekend, asserting Israel has the right to defend itself. The Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 12 media workers have been killed since the war started. On Friday, Reuters journalist Issam Abdullah died in an Israeli artillery strike near the Israel-Lebanon border while filming a live stream. Two of his colleagues were injured in the attack. This is Abdullah's mother.
They don't want the truth to come out. They don't want their crimes to come out. They were sitting where there was no shelling, nothing. They were filming the shelling from afar. Why would they bomb them?
We'll speak with one of Isom's closest friends, a reporter, Lema Alarian, later in the broadcast. Elsewhere, journalists from BBC Arabic say they were pulled from their vehicle by Israeli police in Tel Aviv and held at gunpoint. And on Sunday night, a right-wing mob attacked the home of the Israeli left-wing and ultra-Orthodox journalist Israel Frey. The mob accused him of being a traitor for speaking out against the killing of Palestinian civilians. Meanwhile, Israeli Communications Minister Shlomo Karhi is pushing emergency measures that would allow police to arrest citizens and journalists whose content, quote, harms national morale, unquote. Here in the U.S., HuffPost reports the State Department instructed officials not to use certain terms when speaking in public about the war, including de-escalation, ceasefire, end to violence, and restoring calm. Across the U.S. and around the world, protests calling for an end to the genocide of Palestinians continued over the weekend. This is Palestinian-American writer Leila El-Haddad speaking in front of the White House.
We're just here for them mainly and for all Palestinians in Gaza to show them that they have a voice here through us to amplify their voices and the, you know, humanitarian situation right now, in addition to this completely disproportionate collective punishment against an innocent civilian population.
Here in New York, a protest in Brooklyn organized by Jewish Voice for Peace led to the arrests of dozens of people, including two New York State Assembly members, as well as rabbis and descendants of Holocaust survivors. The message of that protest, do not weaponize our grief. The group, If Not Now, is calling on American Jews and allies to protest in front of the White House today. More protests by Jewish groups are planned throughout the week. In Plainfield, Illinois, a six-year-old Palestinian-American child was stabbed to death Saturday in his own home in an anti-Muslim hate crime. The boy's name was Wadia Al-Fayoum. His mother, Hanan Shaheen, was also stabbed in the attack but is expected to survive. Police have charged Joseph Chuba, who is believed to be the victim's landlord, with murder and hate crimes. Illinois State Representative Abdel Nasser Rashid spoke at a Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, press conference in Chicago, warning leaders and media that Muslims and Arabs in the United States could face more violence due to the handling of the conflict in Gaza and Israel.
This was directly connected to the dehumanizing of Palestinians that has been allowed over the last week by our media, by elected officials who have lacked the moral compass and lacked the courage to call for something as simple as de-escalation, as peace.
In Afghanistan, another 6.3 magnitude earthquake struck near the western city of Herat on Sunday, compounding a worsening humanitarian disaster. Thousands of people have died due to repeated earthquakes in the region since October 7th. The World Food Program says the situation is dire following Sunday's quake.
Two more earthquakes have struck Afghanistan this morning, bringing it to a total of 7 earthquakes and multiple aftershocks over the past 8 days. Dozens of villages are affected, some entirely flattened. Those who have survived have lost everything. They are left with no shelter or food.
In Poland, an opposition coalition led by former European Council President Donald Tusk has won weekend parliamentary elections propelled by record voter turnout of more than 70%. It was an unexpected defeat for the ruling right-wing Law and Justice Party, whose popularity never recovered after it sharply restricted access to abortion, sparking the largest protest since the Solidarity Movement of the 1980s. Tusk has promised to reverse a crackdown on the rights of women and LGBTQIA people. He's also pledged stronger ties with the EU and continued support for Ukraine against Russia.
I have been a politician and a sportsman for many years. I have never been so happy in my life with the second place. Poland has won. Democracy has won. We removed the Law and Justice Party from power.
In Ecuador, wealthy businessman Daniel Noboa has been declared the winner in Sunday's snap presidential election. The 35-year-old heir to a banana industry fortune is the youngest person ever elected president of Ecuador. Noboa received about 52% of the vote against 47% for the leftist Luisa Gonzalez, a member of former President Rafael Correa's Citizen Revolution Movement Party. Noboa's win comes as Ecuador faces worsening violence and an economic crisis that's forced thousands of Ecuadorians to flee to the U.S.-Mexico border. The presidential campaign was marred by unprecedented violence, including the assassination of the anti-corruption presidential candidate Fernando Villavicencio in August. In New Zealand, a coalition of two conservative parties has emerged as the winner of Saturday's election. The National Party, led by New Zealand's next Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, won 39% of the vote. It's poised to take power in a right-wing coalition with the populist anti-immigrant New Zealand First Party. The Labour Party of the former Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern won just 27% of the vote. Voters cited the cost of living as their major concern. In Australia, voters have rejected a historic referendum that would have recognized Indigenous peoples in the Constitution and established an Indigenous Voice to Parliament committee. In a joint statement, groups representing Australia's Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islanders called for a week of silence. They wrote, quote, that people who have only been on this continent for 235 years would refuse to recognize those whose home this land has been for 60,000 and more years is beyond reason, unquote. This is Dean Parkin, who led the campaign to support the referendum.
I want to speak very directly to those Australians who voted no with hardness in your hearts. Please understand that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have never wanted to take anything from you. We have never and will never mean you no harm. All we have wanted was to join with you our Indigenous story, our Indigenous culture, and not to take away or diminish what it is that you have, but to add to it, to strengthen it, to enrich it.
In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, at least 8 United Nations peacekeepers have been suspended and detained over allegations of sexual assault. The workers were based in eastern Congo, which has seen violence soar in recent years due to conflict among armed groups. There are over 12,000 UN peacekeepers in the Congo. Many have protested their presence in the country, while DRC President Felix Tshisekedi also called on their withdrawal, saying the UN peacekeeping mission has failed to prevent escalating violence. The 8 UN peacekeepers have been repatriated to South Africa. This is the UN spokesperson.
There's also evidence indicating a serious failure in the exercise of command and control by senior military officials belonging to that same contingent. The relevant authorities are being informed of the allegations, including a request to deploy a national investigation officer.
While the UN can investigate suspected crimes, it has no power to prosecute. UN peacekeeping missions have previously faced sexual abuse reports in Congo, as well as Haiti and the Central African Republic. In Louisiana, hardline Republican Attorney General Jeff Landry has won the governor's race, flipping the seat red after 2 terms under Democrat John Bel Edwards. Landry will rule alongside a GOP-controlled legislature, which has been stymied by Governor Edwards, who vetoed over 300 bills during his time in office. Landry's defended anti-trans laws, censorship in schools, Louisiana's abortion ban, and racist voting maps. And healthcare workers have reached a tentative agreement with Kaiser Permanente a week after some 75,000 employees walked off their jobs for 3 days, the largest ever healthcare strike in U.S. history. The proposed agreement reached Friday includes pay raises with a minimum of $25 an hour in California, $23 an hour in other states. Kaiser also committed to speed up the hiring of new employees to help address ongoing staff shortages. Separately, California Governor Governor Gavin Newsom signed legislation to raise the minimum wage of healthcare workers to $25 per hour over the next decade. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Gaza, where the death toll from Israel's 10-day bombardment has topped 2,750. The dead include over 1,000 Palestinian children. Over 50 Palestinians have also been killed in the occupied West Bank. Over 1 million residents of Gaza have been displaced, including many who fled their homes after Israel ordered the entire northern Gaza Strip to be vacated. More than 1,000 people are believed to be trapped under rubble following Israeli airstrikes. And the humanitarian catastrophe is growing as hospitals are running out of electricity and water due to the Israeli siege. Water's already run out at UN shelters across the Gaza Strip. This is Dr. Mohammed Abu Mogaisib, Deputy Medical Coordinator in Gaza for Doctors Without Borders.
The situation is very difficult. I mean, today we were for 2 hours searching for drinkable water. Even drinkable water is not available anymore. It's very difficult. Food, still there is food. No electricity. No pumping of normal water as well. The hospitals are barely working. I mean, there's a lot of medical staff who left the hospital with their families because they cannot admit. I mean, they are not safe, so they need to stay with their families to evacuate as well. Medication is really decreasing in the private pharmacies as well. So, I mean, it's very dangerous. I mean, they are bombing all the day. So, I mean, there is no humanitarian corridor. Today, I'm in contact with some hospitals, mainly Shifa. Burn unit, there is only one surgeon, one anesthesiologist, no nurses at all in the hospital, in this burn unit especially. They have a lot of shortage, so we don't know what will be tomorrow and where we are going.
Oxfam's Omar Grieb recorded this audio message from Gaza after fleeing the northern Gaza Strip after Israel ordered the area fully evacuated. He described the mass exodus as Nakba 2.0.
Perhaps yesterday was one of the worst days of my life. We spent years hearing from our grandparents about Nakba and what that was and how they felt. And I think yesterday we had the chance to actually see it with our own eyes. When we're all pushed into mass expulsion to go from north and center Gaza into southern Gaza. And it was really horrible. People spent over 14 hours in an influx of a sea made of people, just walking with their belongings, holding children, holding sick people, holding people with disability, just walking and walking and walking under the sun, begging any passing car to take them. But most cars were filled to the brim. It was Nakba 2.0. happening right in front of our eyes, and we are actually a part of it. I don't know how and when we reached the south, but people kept coming. The streets were frantically busy, and I saw so many people just taking the streets, like putting their children and their belongings in the street and just sitting there, because most really left aimlessly with nowhere to go and no one to seek refuge to. And on top of that, they talked about a safe humanitarian route, and then they bombed two trucks filled with people. Tens were dead. I saw the bombing place. I don't know what's gonna happen next.
That was Oxfam's Omar Grieb speaking from Gaza. Many Palestinians say there's no place for them to go. This is Mohammed Alaham, a grandmother speaking from a hospital in Khan Yunis next to her 4-year-old granddaughter, who is the only member of her family to survive after Israel bombed their home.
They were sitting inside the house. My sons and one of their mothers-in-law were at his house. Suddenly, without warning, they bombed the house. 14 people were killed. Only this girl, my granddaughter, Fula, survived. I hope she'll get better and stay safe and heal. May their souls rest in peace. God is the one who gives patience to people. May God keep me alive to take care of her, and she will be a good person. She is the only person alive from her father's family who is martyred. Also her brother, sister, mother, grandmother from her mother's side, her uncles, all of them, 14 people all at once.
In Israel, family members who have loved ones kidnapped by Hamas held protest over the weekend demanding their safe return. Israel now believes Hamas is holding 199 hostages, a figure that's higher than previous estimates. This is Avichai Brodetz, a farmer from Kibbutz Kfar Aza. His wife and three children were taken captive in Gaza, to Gaza.
And my kids are over there, along with my wife, I hope in good health. And I want them to come back home in good health. And I came here, this is where decisions are being made in Israel. If I could go to the center of Gaza and do the same thing, I would. And I wish I could go there someday. We have to stop. I think we got this right now as a sign from God just to stop the bloodshed. And I ask Hamas, which is holding my family, I hope again in good health, please stop. And the Israeli government to please stop and just bring the women and children back.
We're joined now by Omar Shachar, Israel and Palestine director at Human Rights Watch. He's joining us from Chicago. Omar, tell us the latest. It's so difficult to make contact with people in Gaza right now. What you understand is happening. Israel demanding that the entire population of northern Gaza, which is the main population center, including Gaza City, must move south of Khan Yunis. Then, though, that we heard that they were bombing Khan Yunis. Talk about the situation now.
We're witnessing a situation that's simply not fathomable for any of us on the outside. We're talking about a population that has now for days been without electricity, that has been without water, that has been without, for large parts of it, without internet, that's been without food, that's been without aid. Hundreds of thousands have left northern Gaza. You know, if they're lucky, they've been able to get to relatives and family homes south of Wadi Gaza, but many, do not have that privilege and, are making temporary accommodations. They're under constant bombardment. We've seen some of the more intense bombing of Gaza take place over the last 24 to 48 hours. There have been reports of people killed as they were taking a safe route out of Gaza. The hospitals are operating on generators, which are running out of fuel. People are now resorting to water that's unfit for human consumption. There are people that have not been able to leave northern Gaza because you have there Gaza's main hospital. You have people with disabilities. You have older people, and they're terrified of what might come ahead. You have Israeli officials who are signaling their intent to commit large-scale atrocities. So we really have a terrifying situation where people in Gaza are saying their goodbyes to the world. They're not sure, whether or not they'll make it to the evening, to tomorrow morning. The humanitarian situation, despite reports, people are not being allowed, have not been allowed to leave via Rafah as of the time we're speaking. Aid is still not getting in. Electricity is still not getting in. There's, no confirmed reports of even water having come back in. So it's a really desperate situation.
Heard that Secretary of State Antony Blinken had pushed them to turn the water back on, but because the electricity isn't on, it couldn't be pumped.
Exactly. I mean, in order for water to be provided, you obviously need the electricity to allow the water to be pumped. You also need the ability for the desalination plant to operate. You need electricity. Water infrastructure has been damaged in the airstrikes. And again, the water was only being provided to a certain part of southern Gaza, which is clearly part of the Israeli government's strategy of trying to empty northern Gaza of its population. There are obviously many other areas in Gaza. So right now, people have no choice but to turn to water, which is unfit for human consumption and which carries the risk for those who drink it of waterborne illnesses. So amid everything else, not having water, as the UN has said, water is life and Gaza is running out of life.
Omar Shachar, in a long Twitter thread you posted on Saturday, you warned Israeli authorities are signaling their intent to commit mass atrocities. You cite a number of Israeli officials making statements suggesting precisely that. Can you document what you're saying and what they've been saying?
Absolutely. I mean, we have seen rhetoric from the Israeli government that signals that they hold the entire 2.2 million people of Gaza responsible for the heinous attacks that took place on October 7th. You have the president of Israel, Isaac Herzog, who said very clearly that the entire nation of Gaza is responsible. He notes that the people there could have risen up, you know, to topple the Hamas government. You have statements from Israel's energy minister, who was responsible for cutting the water, the fuel, the electricity, who has similarly talked about, you know, cutting off the last drop of water and the last battery until they're defeated. Again, he's referring, it's a statement that refers both to Hamas authorities, but also to evacuating the entire population. You have statements, of course, from Israel's defense minister that's gotten much attention about fighting human animals, declaring an entire siege on Gaza. You have Israel's UN ambassador that was on CNN a couple of days ago and spoke about how, you know, let's remember that Hamas, you know, that the population of Gaza elected Hamas. Of course, he neglects to mention that nearly half of Gaza's population are children who weren't even, you know, alive to vote at the last time there were elections. All these statements should worry the international community because they're not happening in a vacuum. They're happening as the Israeli government reduces entire neighborhoods and blocks to rubble, as hundreds of children and civilians have been killed in relentless bombardment, 6,000 bombs dropped in a 25-by-7-mile area. I mean, an open air prison. So these statements aren't happening in a vacuum. They're happening amid the most intense bombardment of Gaza we've maybe ever seen, in a situation where more than a million people, according to reports, have been displaced from their homes. So the international community must act to stop this. There is a moment that we can try and stop this, and we must do so before it's too late.
I want to play for our audience Israeli President Isaac Herzog claiming no one is innocent in the Gaza Strip, including civilians.
We are working, operating militarily according to rules of international law, period, unequivocally. It's an entire nation out there that is responsible. It's not true. This rhetoric about civilians not aware, not involved, it's absolutely not true. They could have risen up, they could have fought against that evil regime which took over Gaza in a coup d'etat, but we're at war. We are at war. We're at war we are defending our homes. We're protecting our homes. That's the truth. And then when a nation protects its home, it fights. And we will fight until we break their backbone.
We will fight until we break their backbone. I want to turn to your post on Saturday where you wrote, history teaches us that when there are clear calls to commit large-scale atrocities by parties capable of doing so and actions taken consistent with those words, they need to be taken seriously and stopped. That's where we are today in Israel and Palestine, a descent into darkness. Omar Shakir, if you can take it from there.
Yeah, I mean, President Herzog talked about breaking their back. They have broken the back of the people of Gaza in a way that's simply unprecedented. The statement that the Israeli government is complying with international law is pure fiction. I mean, we know they've cut, you know, vital necessities, as we've discussed, to the entire civilian population. They've sealed the crossings. We know that they have, you know, bombed in a way that, again, you know, is reduced, as has been proudly boasted by the Israeli Air Force on Twitter, of reducing entire neighborhoods and blocks to rubble. You know, we really need to take note of these statements because the Israeli government, and again, that what's striking here is that it's not meeting the sort of pushback that one would expect in a situation like this. I mean, it took days for Europe and the United States even to reiterate basic platitudes about the need to comply with international humanitarian law. You're not seeing sufficient effort taken to warn of the risks to Gaza's population. It is a situation that, as we speak, is deteriorating and not enough is being done to stop it.
I want to ask you about white phosphorus. You tweeted, Human Rights Watch tweeted October 12th, Israel's used white phosphorus in military operations in Gaza and Lebanon, putting civilians at risk of serious and long-term injuries. White phosphorus causes excruciating burns and can set homes afire. Its use in populated areas is unlawful. Israel's denied this. What proof do you have of this, Omar Shaker?
I mean, Israel also denied in 2009 when Human Rights Watch documented, and that turned out to be false, as was disproven by numerous other voices. Human Rights Watch, verified this evidence. It's confirmed. We were able to take video footage that took place both in Lebanon and Gaza, verify that it was recorded when it was taken. We ran these by weapons and munitions experts who confirmed that it was, that what was shown was white phosphorus. And then we interviewed people who live in the communities where the white